Hello, everyone, and welcome to NEBI, the podcast that tells the stories behind Pittsburgh's history, mysteries, myths, and misanthropes. I'm April Johnston, your researcher, writer, producer, and host. And as you've probably guessed, I'm a Pittsburgh girl. I'm also a boomerang. I left Pittsburgh for a job in my mid-20s, met a guy, got married, had a daughter, and decided we absolutely had to move back. Because where else are we going to raise her? Now that I'm settled in Pittsburgh once again, re-exploring all it has to offer, this time with two newbies in tow, I find that I don't know as much about my city as I thought I did, or wanted to. So I decided to get NEBI. I admit, this podcast is really just a good excuse for me to dig into the stories I find fascinating. But I thought some of you might want to come along for the ride. In the months ahead, I'll explore legends passed down through generations and introduce you to a few characters you've probably never heard of. But today, in the first episode, we're headed back to 1956 to reinvestigate one of Pittsburgh's most enduring mysteries, the fate of a crashed B-25 bomber. The legend begins on the afternoon of January 31st, when the B-25, on a training mission, flying low, its engines silent, ditched into the Monongahela River, near what is now Sandcastle. Drivers on the Homestead High-Level Bridge parked their cars and watched it happen. They stared as the plane headed toward them, dipping lower and lower in the sky. When it finally passed overhead, it missed the bridge by only 25 feet. It splashed into the Mon, spewing a geyser into the sky, and floated for about a mile before slipping into the fast-moving, muddy water. And that is the last time anyone saw it. Or we think. The B-25 Mitchell bomber took off from Nellis Air Force Base in Las Vegas on January 30th, 1956. The plane was designed to be a bomber, but outfitted as a passenger and cargo plane, and so it was able to carry 7 men that day. 3 were listed as pilots: Major William Dotson, Captain John Jameson, and Captain Stephen Tabak. 2 were listed as crew chief: Staff Sergeant W.F. Susie and Airman Second Class Charles Smith. The last 2 men aboard, Captain Gene Ingram and Master Sergeant Alfred Allman, were listed as passengers, and the crew's mission was to deliver them to Andrews Air Force Base, just outside of Washington, D.C. The first leg of the cross-country journey took them to Tinker Air Force Base in Oklahoma. From there, they were supposed to refuel and immediately continue to Selfridge Air Force Base in Michigan. But Michigan, as it often is in January, was covered in snow and ice, and so they decided to stay the night in Oklahoma. The next morning, with conditions in the north only slightly more favorable, they departed for Selfridge with Captain Jameson at the controls, and landed without incident around 1 that afternoon. Word was that refueling at Selfridge could take up to 3 hours. Later, investigators would cite this as the reason the crew left without filling the tank that day. Captain Dotson, who would anchor the Michigan to Pennsylvania leg of the mission, likely was the one to do the math. It was cold that afternoon, really cold. And in those days, you had to get out of the cockpit and shove a stick into the fuel tank to check the levels. No one wanted to do that. And after fueling up at Tinker, there should have been about 375 gallons left, more than enough to get to Harrisburg. So the crew, minus Captain Tabak, who stayed behind to take care of some business at Selfridge, took off at 2:45 and headed east. Captain Ingram and Sergeant Susie sat in the forward crew compartment, Airman Smith and Sergeant Allman in the rear. As far as we know, it was a mostly uneventful flight as it crossed Ohio, checking in as scheduled over Windsor, Cleveland, Akron, and Columbiana. Though he had a favorable tailwind and was making good time, somewhere over Butler, Dotson noticed how quickly the plane was eating fuel. By the time he reached New Alexandria, a small town north of Latrobe, he was down to 120 gallons and falling fast. At that rate, they wouldn't make Harrisburg. Dotson had to think quickly. He decided to turn back toward Pittsburgh, hopeful he could nurse the now near-empty tank to the airport and make an emergency landing on one of its runways. But as he approached the city and spotted the brown rope of the Monongahela, the fuel gauge read empty. It wasn't Dotson's first ditch. He had to abandon his ship during World War II when he was shot out of the sky off the coast of Italy. Master Sergeant Allman was familiar with disaster, too. He'd been injured in a plane crash in Alaska years before. So when the plane belly-smacked them on at 4:10 p.m., those men probably led the escape, quickly climbing out of the cabin and onto the wing, where they felt the first shock of icy water on their skin. Then they jumped, one by one, into the Monongahela River. The first call to Pittsburgh police came in at 4:13, and many more followed. River patrol boats and commercial towboats immediately put out, hoping to save survivors a grueling swim. A tugboat crew spotted Airman Second Class Smith clinging to a log and hauled him aboard. River patrol plucked Captain Jameson out of the water only a few minutes later. Both men were taken to the North Shore, near Hazelwood. Meanwhile, on the south side of the river, police officers and railroad workers raced along the banks, tossing ropes into the river. They were hoping the remaining four men would grab on. A trucker from Ohio named Don Devine was driving East Carson Street, headed for U.S. Steel in West Mifflin, when he saw a commotion near the water. Devine was a paratrooper with the 101st Airborne Division in World War II, so it wasn't surprising that he parked his rig and dashed across the railroad tracks toward the problem. He spotted Allman right away, struggling in the fast-moving water. Without thinking, Devine waded into his shoulders, grasping for an arm or a leg, but the current ripped the master sergeant away and carried him downstream. Devine wouldn't give up. He fought his way back to shore, where he met Baldwin Police Lieutenant Charles Colosi and patrolman Aldo Gaburi. Together, the men ran alongside Allman until he managed to grab onto a bush. As they pulled him out, Allman gasped, "Save my buddies." Colosi glanced downstream, where he could just make out another airman, bobbing and struggling. Colosi was about to break for him when the figure sank from sight. Today, we know that was either Captain Ingram or Sergeant Susi. Both were lost that night. Whichever man Colosi saw, he'd made it a third of the way to shore and within 50 feet of his would-be rescuers. It was all over within 17 minutes. Four of the six airmen had been loaded into ambulances and taken to nearby hospitals, St. Joseph, McGee, and Montefiore. But the water had been so cold that evening that in those 17 minutes, Jameson suffered frostbite on his legs and Allman exposure. The abandoned B-25 floated for about a mile before it finally sank. That evening, Colonel Edward F. Roddy, the commander of the Air Force unit in Pittsburgh, issued this statement. The plane, a B-25, gave out of fuel. The gauge was apparently wrong. The engines quit. To avoid hitting any homes, the plane was intentionally landed in the river. They searched for weeks. The Air Force, the Coast Guard, Army engineers, and Police River Patrol. Helicopters circled the skies above the triangle, looking for debris and oil slicks. Patrol boats dragged grappling hooks along the riverbed, from the Homestead Bridge to the confluence of the Mon and the Ohio. Once, they managed to snag what they thought was a wing, but it slipped back into the river, and the swift current lifted and swung the hooks, so they couldn't grab it again. How far the plane had traveled, and if it had stopped, were anybody's guess. Some were certain the plane would have gotten tangled in the Mon's U-shaped turn near Beck's Run Road in Hayes. Others felt sure the B-25 had reached the point, and pointed to a busted telephone cable embedded on the river bottom near the 10th Street Bridge. The theory was the plane had punctured the line as it scraped its way along the riverbed. And then there was the theory that became a legend so pervasive that decades later, most people simply accepted as truth. The government swept in overnight, plucked the plane out of the Monongahela, and took it away, never to be seen again. This wasn't the first military plane to go missing in Pittsburgh. It wasn't even the first plane to be swallowed by the Mon. So what made this plane so important that the military had to go in after it? Well, Pittsburghers, as we do, floated a few theories. The plane was carrying a nuclear bomb, a chemical agent, a group of Las Vegas showgirls, Howard Hughes, and perhaps most unbelievably, the Grand Duchess Anastasia, the daughter of Russian Tsar Nicholas II, who, another mystery holds, escaped execution at the hands of Bolshevik secret police in 1918. How she ended up on a B-25 training mission has never been explained. Let me just pause here for a moment and admit I have no idea what happened to this plane. Maybe the government did swoop in and retrieve it. Or maybe people just really needed to believe that. It was 1956, after all, the middle of the Cold War, when danger felt close and imminent. Maybe it was comforting to think the military had the capability to locate a B-25 in a swollen river, in the dark, and use a host of heavy equipment to extract it, all without anyone noticing. But Occam's razor would say no. It couldn't possibly be. There are too many variables, too many unknowns. It seems a lot more likely that it's still down there. Somewhere. Right? Well, that's exactly what the B-25 Recovery Group has been trying to prove for years. The B-25 Recovery Group is made up of a core of four men who believe, or who eventually came to believe, that the B-25 is still in the river. The effort began in the early 90s with John Aldrich, who was living in Pittsburgh while earning his master's degree. He was fascinated by the mystery of the missing B-25, so he gathered all of the information he could find on the topic: old newspaper stories, military records, and investigative reports. One day, he started having trouble with his computer and called in tech guru Steve Byers for help. While Byers was working, he came across a press release Aldrich had written about the plane and saved to his hard drive. Aldrich was out to prove that popular opinion and the work of fellow armchair investigators was wrong. The military hadn't pulled the plane out of the river. It was still there. Most people regarded his research the same way Byers did that day, with total disbelief. No way it's still in the river, Byers scoffed after reading it. The military pulled that plane out of the water decades ago. Aldrich told Byers to read all of the research before he came to any conclusion. So Byers did, digging through boxes of paperwork over months and months. In the end, he was swayed. So were riverboat captain and biologist Bob Shima and retired Air Force intelligence officer Matt Punzik. they believe the plane, after being lifted by that grappling hook in the first days of the search, tumbled back into the river and settled into a known 50-foot-deep gravel pit near Beck's Run Road, disappearing under a blanket of silt and debris. But when you're up against more than 60 years of folklore, including a guy who claims to have helped the military smuggle the plane out of the city, you have to arm yourself with some pretty convincing evidence. Byers, as the group's keeper of the file, has committed their facts and theories to memory. Byers looks like a computer guy. He appears younger than his age and dresses casually. He likes to top his brown hair with a B-25 Recovery Group ball cap, just to see how many people stop to talk to him about the plane. He starts each conversation with talk of fuel. People want to know why the B-25 ran out of it. Days after the crash, after he was released from Montefiore Hospital, the pilot, Dotson, told reporters he had no idea why the plane was losing fuel. Byers thinks he knows. The crew landed at Selfridge Air Force Base in Michigan just after 1, and didn't take off again until just before 3. That's nearly 2 hours of idling that no one seems to have accounted for. When he took off, Dotson would have had well below the 375 gallons he thought he carried in his tank. And he wasn't flying through thin desert air anymore. He was cutting through the wintry north, which would eat more fuel. The plane wasn't sabotaged to hide Howard Hughes or a chemical weapon, as some people think. Dotson had simply miscalculated. As for the handful of Pittsburghers who claim they saw the military pull the plane out of the river, or alleged to have helped move it, the B-25 Recovery Group thinks that's a case of mistaken identity. Remember, the B-25 wasn't the only plane that went missing in the Mon. A DC-3 dropped into the river in 1954 near McKeesport and was pulled out the next day. Byers believes this is the plane people are thinking of when they talk about a military recovery. The military, for its part, says it never touched the B-25. Their affiliation with that machine ended when it called off the search in February of 1956. And to the detractors, who think something as big as a plane couldn't possibly be lost in a river, Byers offers this. The twin-engine B-25 wasn't exactly a massive piece of flying equipment. It had a wingspan of 67 feet, 7 inches, and measured 51 feet long. Like a school bus, with wings, Byers describes it. The Monongahela in that area is about 500 to 1,000 feet wide, depending on where you stand. That means there are about 1,000 possible resting places for every mile of river. I'd say that qualifies as a needle in a haystack. The recovery group discovered just how large that proverbial haystack is in 1995 when they searched the riverbed with sophisticated sonar equipment, working a grid for 10 to 12 hours a day. They found a lot of stuff down there. Just not the missing plane. At this point, they faced some backlash. The terms conspiracy theorist and crazy were bandied about. But they weren't deterred. In 2014, the group applied for a permit with the Army Corps of Engineers to dredge the river. Their 2 decades of research garnered them enough information and enough respect that in 2017, they received that coveted approval. They plan to drill every 5 feet in the area of the gravel pit where they believe the plane has long been hidden. They are cautiously optimistic. When you dig out the bottom of what was once a very polluted river, you don't know what you're going to find, Byers says. What's left of the B-25, if it's down there? Maybe an engine block, probably fuel bladders and tires. But aluminum? Aluminum in that caustic of a river probably didn't have a long life, Byer says. So we may soon have an answer to our city's favorite mystery. The possibility stirs complicated emotions for Byers. He'd love to be the guy who finally solves the puzzle, to prove that his group's theory was the right one, all along. The Heinz History Center has already agreed to display whatever the group finds. But if they do solve the puzzle, if they find something, they're also ending 6 decades worth of lore, passed along like a collective heirloom from one generation of Pittsburghers to the next. Sometimes, Byers says, I ask myself, do we really want to debunk it? It's such a great mystery. Thanks for listening to the first ever episode of Nebby. Today's episode was written, produced, and narrated by April Johnston, that's me, with production help from David Smith, that's my very patient husband. To learn more about the research and music used in this episode, head to nebbypittsburgh.com. If you like Nebby, tell all your friends, and be sure to subscribe to the podcast so you don't miss us next month, when Nebby returns with more stories of Pittsburgh's history, mysteries, myths, and misanthropes.